This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Happy Friday, everyone. You're listening to Let's Go There with Shira and Ryan. And boy, am I excited for the weekend.
I am too. I love when the weekend comes around because I can finally get to relax.
I know. Isn't that sad? Like, I go on Instagram and I see all those posts like, oh, if you're only looking forward to the weekend, then you're not doing the right thing. But I'm like, I feel like I'm doing the right thing. It's just that, you know, the weekends, it's not the same schedule. It's just like there's a little bit of more breathing room.
And I'm sorry, those people that are saying that, they clearly have nothing that they're doing. They're probably living in their mom's basement wishing that they had more going on.
Actually, it's the people that have like a ton of money that are like, you got to go after your passions no matter what. You shouldn't be working for money.
Screw them. If they want to donate some money to me, go ahead. My hands are open and my pockets are empty.
So, and speaking of the weekend, I also feel like the weekends are the only times that I ever catch up with people in a safe way. Like, I don't see a lot of people, as you know, Ryan, even though you like to drag me and I act like I do.
Think they know that you don't social distance,
no, that's
but it's
not
okay.
True.
Let's keep it moving.
So I'm supposed to have, a date tonight, but this is like, you know, dating and being single during these times is challenging. It's beautiful because you get to know yourself, but it's challenging.
Yeah, I think you're only saying it's challenging because you're saying that this guy has stood you up a couple times.
No, that's not what I'm saying. He just hasn't showed up.
Oh, okay.
Because right. He was running late and he doesn't live in LA. Anyway.
It's fine. Listen. I just want to know, Shira, when will you find, I don't know, a good guy?
A good guy.
It's not good for you.
Well, I am taking submissions, applications.
I bet you are.
You know, you can slide into my DMs at Shira Lazar. If you're listening and you have my number, feel free to text me because
okay.
I know some people. No, I know there's actually some guys,
Shira,
who I do know who listen.
This is not Match.com. Are you really?
Match.com. Like, what do you think I am, like old?
Yes, I do. Thank you for that. Let's move on to the show.
What's trending this hour? Okay, the majority of schools in California will not be reopening for in-person education this fall. And here is Governor Gavin Newsom announcing that at a news conference today.
We are now putting forth guidelines that say schools can physically open for in-person education when the county that they're operating in has been off our monitoring list for 14 consecutive days. However, schools that don't meet this requirement, they must begin the school year this fall through distance learning.
Now, under the new guidance, staff and students in third grade and above will be required to wear face coverings in classrooms. Students from kindergarten through second grade are not required, but encouraged to wear them.
Very good. Very good. We'll see how that works out.
Yeah. And it seems like these governors are taking control of the situation because we know where the administration stands on all this.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, 87, Supreme Court Justice. Yes, she is undergoing chemotherapy to treat a recurrence of cancer.
Poor baby.
But thankfully, she added that the treatment is yielding positive results and that she remains fully able to continue in her post.
I mean,
now, that's someone, Ryan, who does not wait for the weekend.
She is literally the immortal. She is not going to die. She is going to be around for the next 18,000 years. And I can't wait. I'm like, obsessed with her.
Do you think that she's the type of person on a Friday like, oh, I just can't wait for the weekend. I'm tired.
I mean, she's probably... I hope she's like that because that means she can just relax, but she's probably more so in pain and just trying to stay alive.
Oh, no.
She is.
Earlier this week, as we know, she was treated at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore after having a fever and chills. So get better soon, RBG.
She's such a hero.
Oh, she's incredible. And now we're changing things up on What's Trending this hour, and we're moving into the Tea Report.
Oh, yeah. So here are some pop culture stories that are trending. So Tamar Braxton, she's a singer. She's Toni Braxton's sister. She was rushed to the hospital after a possible overdose. Families are asking for prayers. So here's the deal. Tamar Braxton is recovering in the hospital after being found unresponsive. Tamar and her partner have been staying at the Ritz-Carlton residences in downtown Los Angeles. And he actually found her unconscious. He called 911. And reports are suggesting that Braxton has been drinking and appeared to have consumed an unknown number of prescription pills.
So that's really sad.
Oh, so sad. But let's move on to some good news, though. You know, a judge actually is allowing Monique, a comedian, the discrimination lawsuit against Netflix to proceed. So basically, a California judge has given Monique the okay to proceed with her racial and gender bias lawsuit against Netflix after they initially only offered her $500,000. Y'all, this is a huge win for her. Monique's lawyer actually told The Hollywood Reporter today's rulings is an important victory for Hollywood talent who, just like all other workers, need protections against retaliation if they raise concerns about pay discrimination during the hiring process. So we will see what happens as things develop.
Ruth, I'm happy she is continuing the fight. Mm-hmm. Now, coming up, the Confederate flag was just banned from military bases, but is there a loophole? We find out next in 10 minutes. Today, the Pentagon unveiled a new policy that effectively bans the display of the Confederate flag, but they didn't actually name it in the policy. How does that even work? Back with us is Fox News contributor Richard Fowler. Happy Friday. Thanks for being here.
Happy Friday, Sharon Ryan. It's almost the weekend.
Yes. Feeling your energy. Yes. So how is the flag banned without it actually being named? How does this work?
So it's a very interesting twist. So clearly what the Defense Department is trying to do is there's a lot of African Americans who serve in our military and our armed forces, a lot of Latinx folks that serve in our military and armed forces. And the ideal here is this flag is very offensive to Black people. And so they need to get it off military bases so they can make Black people feel welcomed in the workplace. And to be very frank, beyond just African Americans, there's a lot of just regular Americans who find the Confederate flag to be rather offensive because it speaks to a part of American history, which is sick and disgusting and uphold slavery. But I digress. So what Esper, the defense secretary, basically did here was he listed all the flags that are allowed to be displayed on military installations, being very careful to ensure that the Confederate flag was not one of those flags listed to be displayed, in this way avoiding ire from the President of the United States, because it seems very clear that all of the President's cabinet secretaries are definitely afraid of him.
So I guess, why was the Confederate flag even displayed on military bases anyway? Is there like a historical reason that was like claimed or something?
There is no historical reason claim. I think it's the same reason as why, you know, there's still Confederate statues that litter the country. It's sort of the same, the argument that you hear people on the right make, or those who support the Confederate flag or these Confederate statues, is this is about heritage, American heritage. And my response to that always, Ryan, is whose heritage is about? Because think about what the meaning of that flag was for. That flag was created to represent a group of individuals who decided to leave the United States of America because they wanted to keep people that looked like me and you, Ryan, enslaved.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like this is such a cop-out. And like, why did they even put this policy in place if they weren't going to include that? Again, we're talking to Fox News contributor Richard Fowler about the fact that the Pentagon is effectively banning Confederate flags on all military property without even including it in there. Do you think that anyone's going to be fighting back against this?
We'll have to wait and see. I mean, so it's always very interesting in Washington when you see a story like this drop on a Friday. If this was something that the Pentagon was very proud to do, they would, you know, release this story on a Monday or a Tuesday or a Wednesday when everybody's paying attention. But we like to call this part of the Friday news dump. Last week's Friday's news dump was when Donald Trump decided that he was going to commute Roger Stone's sentence. Mm-hmm. So clearly the Pentagon's not trying to get the most attention to this story. I'm happy to some extent. I guess it's a bittersweet moment that you'll no longer see Confederate flags on American military bases all across the world. But I mean, I think once again, we're asked the question as to why we're having this debate in 2020, centuries almost after the Confederacy fell and we abolished slavery in America.
And also there are exceptions to the ban, including museum exhibits, license plates, grave sites, and works of art where the nature of the display or depiction cannot reasonably be viewed as an endorsement of the flag by the Department of Defense. Like, what does that
mean? So now let me be very clear. I am a big believer that we should memorialize both these Confederate generals as well as the Confederate flag in museums and in textbooks, because I think it is important and it's paramount that America's young people, and for that matter, to some extent, clearly America's old people and America's middle-aged folks, understand what those flags meant, what those generals stood for, and they know that what they stood for was hate. It was bigotry, it is anti-American, it is treasonous, and it speaks to the most disgusting part of American history. And I think we need to know about all of his gory details. I think what we've seen all across this country, in textbooks and classrooms all across this country, is people try to sugarcoat what the Civil War was actually about, or sugarcoat the pains of slavery. And I don't think we should do that anymore. I think we should talk about it in explicit details so people know about it, they can name it, so they're unlikely to repeat it.
Yeah, just because you delete something doesn't mean it's not about deleting it. It's just not about celebrating it. Like, I try to, like, we need to talk about the difference and have clarity around that, because people think
and memorialization are two different things. Memorializing something means you are celebrating it. Commemorating it is saying it happened, it was bad, and we should say this happened, and we should remember why it happened, so we don't repeat it again.
Never forget. Yes. Richard Fowler, thanks again for being here, and have a great weekend.
Same to y'all. Have a great weekend.
Again, you can follow Richard on Instagram at Richard A. Fowler and check him out on Fox News. And now coming up, Florida dealt a huge blow to ex-felons voting rights for this election. We break down the impact those votes could make when we return. Florida just made it difficult for ex-felons to vote in the November election, which brings up the bigger question, what rights do ex-felons have and not have after finishing their sentences? And obviously, this isn't right, but why does this keep happening? And what are advocacy groups doing about this? Or perhaps political officials, local officials. Eliza Orleans is with us right now, candidate for Manhattan DA and a career public defender. Thanks for being here around this. I know this is something you're passionate about.
Thank you so much for having me. It really is. And, you know, the one thing I would even point out before we even start this discussion is the language that we use around people who've been convicted of felons.
Okay. Mm.
I think to call someone a felon, it kind of like dehumanizes them in a way, or to say, oh, criminal, felon, inmate, prisoner, it dehumanizes them and it allows people to discriminate against people who've previously been convicted of crimes. Mm. So like, I encourage people to use the language of people who've previously been incarcerated, people who've been convicted of a felony, it's centering the personhood of the human being.
I love that. Thank you so much for clarifying
that. I like that as well.
Yeah, we love learning here as well with everyone listening. So that's a big thing.
So Eliza, why are voting rights such a big issue when it comes to people who have previously been, you know, to prison or been convicted of felonies?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, so much of what we see in our criminal legal system and then in subsequently disenfranchising people who've been convicted of felonies is that it's just a continuation of Jim Crow laws. It's a way to continue to marginalize and disenfranchise and suppress the voices of the same people who were previously enslaved in this country. And so I think that this modern era, what we're seeing, and especially in places like Florida, where they're trying to restore the voting rights to people who have felony records once they complete their sentences, is that Republican lawmakers don't want to see that, because the people who are predominantly going to have their voting rights restored are people of color, are people who would likely be voting Democratic as opposed to Republican.
That's really scary that that is the case. And then, so how could there be a change if these states who are making these decisions are Republican led? When are we going to be able to see a change here? Because it seems like these rights need to be given to these individuals. Like, this seems a bit ridiculous.
It's absolutely ridiculous. You're completely right. And I think that, you know, we have an inalienable right to vote. I mean, that's supposed to be something that it is a universal principle. It applies to all American citizens, 18 years and older, period. But, you know, these people are just continuing to take away the rights to vote based on these, you know, in unjust reasons. And so I think that what we need is we need our elected officials to be out there and fighting against these felony disenfranchisement laws, and we need to restore people's voting rights because everyone should have the right to vote.
I agree.
Do you think that some of these folks will just go to other states? Is this something that's across the entire country?
No, there are different laws that apply in different states. There are two states that never deprive you of the right to vote, even while you're incarcerated. And then there are a number that once you complete incarceration or once you complete your parole or probation, then you can get your voting rights restored. But I think that disenfranchisement restricts and conflicts with the principles that our country is founded on, which give all adult citizens the right to vote regardless of wealth, income, gender, race, ethnicity, or anything else.
If you're just now joining us, we are talking to Eliza Orland. She is the candidate for Manhattan DA and a career public defender. Now, as far as unpaid labor goes, is that still a big issue in prisons across the United States?
Absolutely. And the prison industrial complex continues to operate in a way that just disenfranchises people in a different way and marginalizes them. And these are people who, if not for their incarceration, could be gainfully employed with the rest of society. But we're seeing these issues where people are having their rights taken away, not just while they're incarcerated, even after they do their time. This is all kind of tied together, which is they are not able to get a job. You know, sometimes even if you complete your sentence, you've been sentenced to a life of unemployment because there are so many places that don't ban the box, meaning they can ask if you've got a previous criminal record when they make a determination as to whether or not to hire you. So it's not just the prison labor issue, but it's the inability to get work afterwards, the having your vote taken away, having your voice taken away afterwards, even after you've paid your debt to society, whatever that means. So I think it's horrifying on all levels.
Eliza Orland is again talking to us. She's a candidate for Manhattan DA, working very hard on that, and a career public defender. I guess, are things changing? And is anyone advocating for these individuals? We know like someone like you is, and you're working towards that. But like, I guess, is there any push to make a change right now?
Yeah, there are a lot of groups out there, you know, that are fighting for getting voting rights restored. I mean, I know the ACLU is doing a lot of work around that. And I think that we're hoping that there are changes made, that we see people get elected. I mean, there were people in the presidential primary this year who were talking about restoring voting rights to all people. And so I think that, you know, hopefully we'll see it across America, state by state, but also federally.
What about New York? Is this happening in New York, like where you are?
In New York, people who are currently incarcerated, people in prison, and people who are on parole cannot vote.
Oh, so is that something that you are going to be as a candidate? Is that something that you would want to see obviously change and fighting for
that? I will certainly speak out about it. Absolutely be speaking out about that issue. You know, unfortunately, as district attorney, I won't have the ability to restore voting rights, but I will, as I have always been, speaking out about these issues because they disproportionately impact Black and brown people who are already being murdered and brutalized by police with impunity and all of these things. The fight for racial justice includes fixing these disenfranchisement laws.
That was Eliza Orland. You can check out more about her run for Manhattan DA at ElizaOrlands.com. Now coming up, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo seems to think that the United States' view of human rights is too broad. We discuss that next in 10 minutes. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo argued Thursday for a more limited U.S. view of global human rights based on the principles laid out by America's founding fathers. So basically, let's not support minorities, including women and the LGBTQ+ communities around the world. Here he is in Philadelphia saying this.
We can't do good at home or abroad if we don't precisely know what we believe and why we believe it. And that's why I asked Professor Glendon to form a commission composed of some of the most distinguished scholars and activists. I asked them not to discover new principles, but to furnish advice on human rights grounded in our nation's founding principles and the principles of the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Because without this grounding, our efforts to protect and promote human rights is unmoored and therefore destined to fail.
So I love how he just says, no new principles. Let's just focus on what was part of the Declaration of Independence, which, you know, Ryan, was drafted in 1776. This is what he wants us to base our human rights on.
Yeah, and I think that's what a lot of Republicans are. They don't look at trying to change or modernize the Constitution. They only want to stick to the problematic roots that was crafted around 1776. So it just makes no sense to me, you know? And I think that's why LGBTQ political representation is so important. I mean, reports are coming out like the LGBTQ Victory Institute, which I believe we've actually had on the show before. But reports from them, according to them, at least 843 lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer people currently serve in elected offices across the United States, you know? And if we continue to have people like Mike Pompeo, who is like, has like this dated type of thinking, and he thinks that only a certain human rights can be considered the ones that we need to be paying attention to, this is why, you know, so many political like people that are a part of our community, they're fighting for this. They're fighting against him because it just makes no sense that he's in charge and he actually feels confident enough to say some crap like this.
Yeah, it's pretty horrifying that he does, and this is what is being put out there. And even if you look at this 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights that he mentions, even if you look at that, you could see that we're not doing that at all. Included in that, amongst many other things, is the right to democracy. We all have a right to take part in the government of our country. Well, you know, what about the conversation we just had about those who've been incarcerated? Like that, their inability to vote, right? What happened to that? The right to public assembly. You know, we've seen that with all the protests recently. What about those peaceful protesters who are gassed, thrown off the streets, or arrested in DC for Trump to have a photo op? And the list goes on and on. But I want to look at this commission that he put together on unalienable rights, who looks at these human rights. And it consists of individuals highlighted by NBCNews.com who are clearly not pro-human rights for everyone, or at least it's like the freedom for them, right? So we've got Mary Ann Glendon, who is leading this group. And that is the former U.S. ambassador to the Vatican and is an outspoken opponent of abortion, has spoken out against same-sex marriage on several occasions. And then GLAAD actually called out Peter Berkowitz, who in 2003 called the Supreme Court ruling that decriminalized homosexuality as dangerous. We have so many others. I mean, others that say same-sex marriage is a sign of the end of times. Jacqueline Rivers, who in 2014 said same-sex marriage diminishes straight unions. Christopher Tollefson, who in 2015 said gender transitions are a mark of heartless culture. I mean, and this is just the beginning. We're scratching the surface. So you can see how terrifying this is if these are the people looking at our human rights.
I mean, yeah, I think that's what we're going through every day.
Yeah. All right. Well, coming up, Kellyanne Conway thinks she knows why Trump's polling numbers are sinking. We've got that clip next with What's Trending This Hour. We are back, and coming up next, we're going to be getting into these new micromanagement tools your boss could implement while you're working from home. Imagine them following your every move on your laptop. How embarrassing it would be to see how much you go on Facebook.
I mean, I feel like you have tried to tell me that. Do you think I'm a micromanager? I feel like I have had people in my life tell me I'm kind of like a micromanager. And I learned it from my mom, to be honest, so I kind of have to accept it.
Oh, you're becoming your mom.
Ew. Would you like to be said that you're becoming your mom?
Well, there are parts of me, like the way I laugh sometimes, and it's, yeah, it is weird, but it happens, Ryan.
That's I'm not like a terrible one. It's not like I'm over here cracking the whip or anything, but sometimes.
Well, the best is when I want to meditate and Ryan thinks I'm sleeping. And how many times do I need to tell you meditation isn't sleeping? It's actually like part of the prep.
You were taking a nap.
Better at my job.
And if y'all saw the video, if y'all follow us on social media, LGT Show, there was a video that was posted where I have to do crazy things sometimes to get Shira to focus on me. And I set a piece of paper on fire and she was like, I'm like, at least you're paying attention to me. Now let's get to work. So
yeah, before you blow up your place. No, listen, let's be clear. No one would ever tell us it is healthy to be on Zoom for 6 hours a day. We almost wanted to break a world record once for how long we could do a Zoom. And this is probably the longest Zoom session ever.
It's true.
Every day we do
this. It's true, but it's worth it because we get to talk to you all and you all get to listen to us just be whatever.
Just We're fall apart.
Yeah.
Just in front of your very eyes or your ears. Okay.
All right. What's trending, Shira?
Yes, we got some good stuff. Here's what's trending this hour. Today on Fox and Friends, Kellyanne Conway claimed that she knows why Trump polling numbers are slacking right now.
Well, I'm going to answer your question about why the president's numbers may be a little softer on the handling of coronavirus. My own view, which is different than some people here, is three things. One, the president's numbers were much higher when he was out there briefing everybody on a day-by-day basis about the coronavirus, just giving people the information. They were out there every day when we had, at some point, 2,500 deaths in one day at the highest level, and I guess it was April or so, March and April. And the president and the task force were there most days giving the information.
That makes sense. It totally makes sense.
Girl.
It seems like actually it was interesting though because she said that she thinks he should go back to doing that and a lot of people don't. So I think it shows a little bit of the tension happening behind the scenes.
I don't know. She's a mess. Honestly a mess. I'm just happy she's wearing makeup now. She doesn't look like a scarecrow.
Oh.
That's no shade. You know. That's no shade.
I must say, between her and Kaylee McEnany, McEnany still just acts like everything is normal, and it amazes me.
You have a girl crush on her, and actually, she was a photo came out yesterday of her binder and how everything is sectioned off with different titles, like LGBTQ, Black Lives Matter, lies. She had one that a tab that said lies. Is that just where she says all of her lies? Like seriously, it's wild to me.
No, I think it's like the lies the media says, like her quote unquote lies.
Maybe.
All right. Well, that is evil. Or just smart. I don't
know. I mean, I have familiar. To give her credit for her organizational skills. I was pretty like,
exactly.
Wow, this is pretty badass of you.
All right. Now, a federal judge ruled today that the Trump administration must begin accepting new DACA applications for the Obama-era program that protects undocumented immigrants who came to the U.S. as children from deportation. This is huge. This is a very big win. It's been nearly a month since the Supreme Court blocked the Trump administration's attempt to end DACA. That ruling is emphasizing that the administration failed to provide an adequate reason to justify scrapping it. So basically they said, like, you're not giving us a good enough reason, so it doesn't make sense.
Hmm. Okay. All right.
it's that simple.
It's that simple.
All right,
simple.
Now let's move into the tea report. What's going on?
All right, here are some pop culture stories that are trending. Y'all, let's start off with Kelly Rowland, and she actually is admitting that she tortured herself for a decade after basically being in Beyonce's shadow. So, you know, she's now one of the judges on Australian's version of The Voice. She was giving advice to a contestant who was insecure about being compared with his brother, who was actually a past winner on Australian Idol and The X Factor. And she basically said this. She said, I know this feeling. Can you imagine what it's like being in a group with Beyonce? I would just torture myself in my head. Like, I can't wear this dress because they're going to say it's like Beyonce.
Oh, I kind of feel bad.
I do feel bad, but girl, that's what happens when you're a part of Destiny's Child and Beyonce's in the star. But she's been vocal about this before. But let's move on to some other TV news as well. Joy Behar and Meghan McCain came to blows on yesterday's episode of The View. Tempers flared on air between her and Joy Behar over Ivanka Trump's pro-Goya stance after the brand CEO praised the president. Here is a clip of this.
You know, you don't have to be so snippy with
she's
me today, Joy.
Talking.
You really don't. I'm talking because I'm paid to talk and it's my job. And that's what I'm doing, Joy. And if you have a problem with it, I don't have to come to work today.
So, Whoopi, what I was going to say was...
You know, honestly, I just feel like they like to bully each other. And I think this is what it is. And I feel like it's just fair game and it really helps the ratings. And I don't know if I'm sad because I really enjoy them arguing or if they're just like really hating each other. But who knows what's going on at this
point. Or they know what they're doing and they're like, when the camera's cut, they're like, good job. Great arguing today. That was just really top notch.
I just don't think they like each other. And I think they try to force us to believe that narrative, but no, they don't like each other. But those are the pop culture stories that are trending right now.
All right. By the way, when we said the Beyonce story, I was like, you remember when we argued over who's Beyonce?
And I am always Beyonce. Who would ever think you
but
were
you,
Beyonce?
When you met me, you said I was Beyonce. That was your way in.
But you
like
know,
to grease
lie.
Me up.
People lie.
You like to make me feel special, and then you just took it away.
People laugh.
All right, coming up, would you let your boss watch you work from home? Well, new technology is making it a possibility. We discuss if it's more harmful than helpful next in 10 minutes. Since the coronavirus outbreak, the number of Americans working from home jumped from 15% to around 50%. And now a lot of employers are adopting remote management software to keep tabs on employees. If this sounds freaky, well, it is. So basically, you would download technology that allows your boss to monitor you from home? What? Back with us is clinical psychologist Dr. Josh Klapo. Welcome back to the show and happy Friday.
Happy Friday. Are y'all monitoring me?
Oh, yeah.
Well, you are being recorded. Yeah.
Oh, right. Yeah. That's true. Okay.
But I'm sure.
Okay. Maybe. Maybe not.
How bad of an idea is this?
It depends what size you sit. No, I think it's bad all the way around. And there's different levels. There's different kinds of monitoring. So, I mean, there's everything from when you've logged on to when you logged off, just basically keeping tabs on how much you're interacting with your computer, to things like where you actually are on the internet, on that computer, to keystrokes, to, in some cases, cameras. I've seen, you know, some employers are asking for people to put cameras in their houses so that they can see them working.
What? Wow.
Yes. I mean, I would just say psychologically, I don't see any good in it. And that may make some employers upset. But the idea to me is, I don't understand why knowing when somebody logs on and off is critical from an accountability standpoint. There are lots of other ways to hold a person accountable, and doing it that way sets up a lack of trust. And as soon as you set up a lack of trust, even if the person's compliant, that you lost a psychological connection that you're going to need, because they may be logging on and off, but they sure as heck aren't doing their absolute best because you just told them you don't trust them.
Right. And I think that's the situation there, right? Where if you don't have any trust in your employees, then it's kind of like, why am I working for you? And so can that really create this uneasiness about, one, I'm already stressed with working at home. I'm stressed probably dealing with family issues and the fear of COVID-19. How does this add on to the workload of emotional and physical stress?
Well, it's huge, Ryan, because if you think about it, let's assume this wasn't the way that you operated, your employer operated all the time. So when you were at work, if they weren't watching your keystrokes at work, why are they doing it now all of a sudden? There is only one reason or message, which is, we want to make sure you're working. So that you've kind of gone from a place of trust to a place of lack of trust. And the stress probably comes more from frustration, more from disappointment. We as humans do not like to be thought of as not trustworthy.
Yeah.
So I mean, that it's more, I would say, guys, it's more than the stress of someone's watching me to the, are you kidding me that I'm an adult and you have to watch me? It's more anger, frustration. And that, I'm telling you, I advise lots of employers, and unless there's a safety and security reason, that would be the only reason, not a productivity reason.
Yeah, we're talking to Dr. Josh Klapo again about these new technologies or softwares that basically keep an eye on the employees. Right. I wish we could do it the other way. That would be amazing. Is this crossing the line?
You know, I think that obviously I'm not a lawyer, and I can't speak to the legality about it. But doing it in a covert way is, if it's not crossing the line legally, it's crossing the line ethically, right?
Yeah.
So again, if you say to your employee, these are the reasons why we need to monitor you at home, maybe safety, maybe security. We need to know when people, we want to get an idea of, I've seen this, we want to get an idea when people are naturally working, right? When do they log on? When do they log off? That here's the reason why we're doing it. And that's what's, let me just say this quickly. If you can't say that as an employer, if you are unable to tell your employee why you're tracking them, then right there is your red flag that you've got a trust issue with your employee.
Well,
also,
I was going to say, I on the other end, if I'm being devil's advocate, What if the employer is just wanting to make sure, like, they're not paying folks to take advantage of a time like this and just sit around and not do it? Because I'm not going to lie to you. I know some folks who say they're on call, but honey, if I talk to them on FaceTime, they're over there playing the video games and they're not really doing their job. So it's kind of like, how do you really trust, like, your employees are doing this thing? Because who has time to waste money?
Absolutely. I agree with you 100%. And again, I advise a lot of employers, look for productivity metrics, right? Mm-hmm. So instead of sneaking up on them, are they meeting their quotas? Are they doing their number of calls? Are they closing deals? There's, you know, we're evaluated. And in some ways, Ryan, this is what I think is kind of weird about it. Let's say you're on and they show that you're on and you're doing all the right stuff, but you're not meeting your metrics. Well, okay, which is more important? So my advice to employers is, if you can't explain why you want to monitor people, then you don't have a good reason to monitor them, unless you suspect. And if you want to monitor their productivity, look at metrics, look at numbers that go to your bottom line, more so than whether how much time they're spending on the computer or not.
I don't care what you're doing in your off time, your personal time, as long as you get the work done. And also, if a boss wouldn't like their boss to do that to them, they should not implement it for others. That's what I always say. All right, Dr. Josh Klapo, you're going to stick with us because after this, we are getting into cognitive dissonance. Okay. This is actually a huge role in how we all perceive the threat of COVID-19. So stick around for that. We discuss how your brain could be playing tricks on you in 10 minutes. The term cognitive dissonance has been thrown around as of late as it relates to what we're going through with COVID-19. And the psychological term might be the reason why some people can ignore facts, science, we know who those people are, or justify actions in order to validate their point of view, no matter what. And back with us to explain all of this is clinical psychologist Dr. Josh Klapo. Okay, Dr. Josh, let's get into this. For anyone who might not understand, how does cognitive dissonance play a role in how we perceive something as a threat, like COVID-19 right now?
And explain it to us like we're kindergartners.
Yeah. No, I know. It's much more understandable for all of us if we explain it in more practical terms than like what the definition is. So think of it this way. As humans, we do not like when our thoughts are inconsistent with our actions. So for example, we use the mask. I am not wearing a mask and I'm getting all this information that wearing a mask is safe. So there's an inconsistency between what I'm thinking, which is I'm not wearing this mask, everyone's telling me it's safe, and my behavior, which is not wearing the mask. We don't like that. We don't like when there's inconsistency between our thought and our behavior. And frankly, as humans, we're too lazy to change our behavior most of the time. So we just change our thoughts. And what we do in this case is we go, oh, look, here's information that says wearing a mask isn't necessary. That information is consistent with my behavior of not wearing a mask. Wait, there's even more information that I can find that says wearing a mask could be dangerous.
Right.
So really the idea of cognitive dissonance is when there is a mismatch between what our actions are and what our thoughts are, we quickly scramble to change our thoughts to match our actions.
Well, Dr. Josh, how much does fear play into that? Because I know you said, like, you know, people, and I totally agree with you, like, people are just too lazy to change their behavior. But I think with change, there's already an inherent fear of, like, well, if I do change it, if it doesn't go into that the way that I need it to go, that makes me feel 100% comfortable, then I just don't want to do it.
That's exactly it. So fear, distress, I mean, in this particular case, Ryan, the behavior itself or the lack of has to do with our safety and our well-being. So if you want to get just deeper, it's exactly what you said, which is if I am not wearing a mask and I'm being fed all this information that wearing a mask is safe, it'll protect me from this virus. If I start to go put that mask on, now I have to accept, quote unquote, that this is dangerous, right? And I've gone from, well, it's not so bad, it's not dangerous, I don't need to wear a mask, to it is. And that's a big deal. The problem that I think we have with the whole mask thing is there is enough sources of information out there. And I'm going to say, as a scientist, I'm trying to be as neutral as I can. There's enough content out there that you can go find what is consistent with your actions. Now, I would argue that a lot of that content is not accurate, but, you know, if you can find it, you ain't going to do it. And it's very problematic also because people wearing masks are trying to, for lack of a better description, hammer on people not wearing masks, saying, you know, you're not doing it right. This is not safe. And that well may be true, but people not wearing masks, that's not going to get them to wear a mask because they already see all that information. They already know all that information is out there.
Yeah, we're talking to Dr. Josh Klapo again, who's a clinical psychologist, about this term cognitive dissonance and how it could be playing a role in this pandemic right now. And in this article that we found on The Atlantic, it also talked about even smoking. Like when it was discovered that smoking could cause lung cancer, it's amazing how many people disassociated from that and created excuses why that might not be the case, for them.
That's exactly. I mean, it's a much easier understanding around smoking, buying an expensive object as we see it, an expensive purchase all the time in retail. I bought this new car or this new electronic equipment, but you know what? It was on sale. So we use that as a way of getting rid of the dissonance between, gosh, I knew that was a lot of money, or in the case of smoking, it's bad for me. So the challenge that we face with the whole mask thing and dissonance is trying to force people to see it your way is not going to work. Really, what's going to get people to do it is showing them that other like-minded people have made a shift.
Got it. So yeah, I was going to say, like, with all this knowledge of this term and how we behave, what can we do with this knowledge right now?
What you want to do is you want to sort of help people who are in this, with the case of a mask, saying it's not good for me, I'm not going to do it, all these reasons. You want to point them to people who are also like them, meaning look at this group. And again, I hate to be political about it, but look at people in your party. Look at people, your friends who weren't wearing masks. They've started wearing their masks. I wonder why.
And I feel like this relates back to racism too, and those types of conversations that we might need to deal with friends, family, colleagues. There is that cognitive dissonance of, like, they're saying, well, they're not a racist, but their actions are different. Or, I mean, is that part of it? Or is that just being like stubborn and somewhat of a sociopath?
No, a lot of times, no. I mean, yes, that's in some cases, but a lot of cases it's exactly that. They honestly believe it. It's the same thing with the mask. I mean, the people who are not wearing the mask, they're not just lying for the sake of lying. They believe that, you know, it's harmful, et cetera. So it's the same thing. What you really have to do is show them the path to change their mindset.
Wow. It's powerful stuff. A lot to dig into. Thank you so much again for being with us, Dr. Josh Klapo, as we navigate these dense conversations and subjects. Appreciate it. Happy Friday. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, guys.
Okay, coming up next, are your friends and family not taking the coronavirus seriously? We discuss how you can sit them down and have the COVID talk. That's in 10 minutes. We all know COVID cases are on the rise, but people still don't seem to understand the severity. And it seems like we're all having to have that talk with our family and friends, you know, the COVID talk. And back with us is licensed psychologist Julie Pike, who focuses on anxiety and trauma to help us navigate all of this. Julie, thanks for being back.
Thanks for having me back.
Okay, so how do you navigate conversations like this? Because I feel like we're going to start to become a community or society where it's like the people that take COVID seriously and the people that don't, and it's going to divide us. It already is.
100%. And I see it every day. And I think two of the things that I would have people think about are boundaries and staying away from shame. Because to quote Brené Brown, my favorite shame researcher, shame is not a teacher. It does not help in any of the conversations that we're having, whether they're political discussions, COVID discussions, conversations about race in America. But I think we all probably know about I statements. So if I'm going to talk to a relative about what they are and aren't doing, saying something rather than you're doing it wrong, which is inherently going to shame people, which means they're going to get defensive and dig in, saying, you know, I would be so much more comfortable talking if we were wearing masks and 6 feet apart. Would you be willing to do that? that's a way of playing to people's compassion. Yeah. And it's so important. And it's, I think it's also ultimately important, you know, the only thing I have to be really clear on is what I'm willing and not willing to do.
But what's the balance of that, though? Because I do feel like we have passed the point of trying to coddle people through understanding the severity of what we're going through, right? And I feel like it's a slap in the face. And when I see, like, thousands or hundreds of people gathering at parties over the 4th of July, and they're just not paying attention to the rules, and they're just disregarding everything. And if you start seeing your friends or your family members doing the same thing, what's the balance of trying to, one, lead with compassion, but also being stern and saying, what are you not getting?
Yeah, no, I fall onto that side as well. And I think, for me, it's about saying, you know, what is true for me, which is I, for example, I know someone who went into, when all of this was beginning, went in with 102 fever into a grocery store without a mask on.
Oh.
Woo! And I thought, ooh, well, there goes our friendship. And, I have such strong feelings about it. And it was before we had really had, it was before we knew anything. It was in mid-March. And I had to say to her, you know, in order to feel like I was conducting myself with integrity, just like, mm-hmm. you know, if someone says something racist or homophobic or, you know, xenophobic to me, I feel like it's part of my integrity to say, I really disagree with that. It hurts me to hear you say that. And,
yeah.
and if you'd like some information why, I'm happy to share it with you, you know, if you are at that time. But what I said to this friend was, you know, I'm really concerned and I am so scared for the people that she came in contact with. And I would ask you not to do that again.
Now, if you're just now joining us, we are talking with licensed therapist Julie Pike. And I think everyone wants to know, when do you cut people off? Because I feel like I'm really good at that.
I think it's a really important question. Like, this is a, we have never before lived in a time where there are so many issues around self-care and boundaries.
Yeah.
That, you know, I think on balance, if a relationship is more harmful than it is, you know, pleasurable or helpful or meaningful, then it's time to distance or to cut off, whatever yeah. is best.
And do you have a conversation or you kind of just distance yourself? Like, you know, we don't need to ghost our friends. We know how that feels if we're dating. It does not feel good.
Honey, is there a way? Several friends.
Is there a way to do it in as respectfully as possible and in integrity?
I think, you know, it depends on the relationship and what you want out of it. For me, I have distance from some people that I have seen doing things that I consider, you know, either scary in terms of COVID or just ignorant in my opinion about, you know, social justice issues. So I've distanced, and I don't usually say, hey, just FYI, I'm distancing from you. But if we're breaking up, like, I think that there is integrity in saying that, you know what, like, this, I think we've grown apart. I think our relationship no longer serves me and I don't really want to have contact again. I wish you well. And that's, you know, that's kind of all I need to say.
That's that.
And if things change, I'm here, but otherwise, peace. Okay. Thank you so much, Dr. Julie Pike, for joining us again.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now coming up, this is juicy. Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot just called White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany a Karen. Find out why next with What's Trending This Hour. We are back. And before we get into What's Trending This Hour, I want to say thank you to my housemate for delivering fries while I was recording. It was a really nice gesture. It really made my day. I did feel bad because producer Chance and Ryan had to listen to me just really enjoying, like orgasmically enjoying those fries.
Yeah, that's just, my only thing.
I apologize.
Shira doesn't know how to, she's one of those type of people that that doesn't chew with her mouth closed and she like, she smacks, which is a very faux pas. It's like, oh my God, all my Southern roots just jump out when I'm just like Stop smacking your lips. I just want to pop her on her hand. I told her, I told her, I'm just going to get my mama on her at this point because that's how she eats. She eats like a Hoover vacuum. It's just sucking up everything in the room.
Well, yeah, because it happens that we're on Zoom, as I mentioned, for hours a day and in front of this mic. So, of course, you're going to hear me. Guess I'll move on to the headline.
I don't want to talk about those fries. You traumatized me.
Okay, let's get into this.
This is stupid.
Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot called Kayleigh McEnany a Karen after the White House press secretary referred to her as a derelict mayor at a briefing.
He'll take action, and the derelict mayor of Chicago should step up and ask for federal help because she's doing a very poor job at securing her streets.
Now, Mayor Lori Lightfoot retweeted that tweet quoting McEnany, saying, as I mentioned, this, "Hey, Karen, watch your mouth." Oh, drag. Okay, let's move on to Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who is allowing for Florida gyms to stay open because fit people are less likely to get seriously sick.
In terms of the gyms, we've not had a lot of problems with that. And so that's not something that I'm gonna close, partially because if you look, you talk to any physician, particularly the people that are under 50, if you're in good shape, you have a very, very low likelihood of ending up in significant condition as a result of the coronavirus. I mean, the people that they're seeing in there have overwhelmingly uncontrolled comorbidities. A lot of folks have hypertension, diabetes, are very morbidly obese. And so I think taking that option away for people to be healthy just doesn't make sense. In terms of the gyms,
that's not true at all. I don't know why people think because you have you're bigger or you're fat or whatever, that you're more unhealthy. Like, that makes no sense to me. There's so many people. Let's bring up for the conversation's sake, everyone loves to try to shade Lizzo. But if you ever been to a Lizzo show, she is one of the most athletic human beings that I have ever seen in my entire life besides Beyonce. Like, the way she moves and puts on a show for probably about 2 hours is incredible. So this notion that fit people are less likely to get sick is not true. Honestly, I'm surprised y'all can even stand up with your eating of the vegan stuff, eating lettuce and grass. Where's the meat?
Oh, now you're attacking the vegans? How did I get into this?
I'm not attacking the vegans. I'm just saying. I hate that every time we're talking about fitness or health, fit people are the ones that are saying that they are more, healthy than bigger people. It's not true.
I don't know about the stats. I know we know pre-existing conditions and it happens. I think there is this generalization that
don't
if you are a certain weight, you have I'm saying I think there is a generalization. That said, members and employees at 5 of Southern California branches of Equinox Fitness clubs, if we're talking about those who are fit, have tested positive for COVID-19. So listen, we're seeing all across the country, people at gyms still test positive. So I don't think you could say just because you're working out, you're not going to get it.
Oh yeah, they go get it.
Including if you're inside and sharing equipment and breathing while you're jogging or doing whatever. All right, well, let's move into what's the tea? Okay, now let's move into the tea report.
All right, so here are some pop culture stories that are trending right now. So Houston rapper Meg Thee Stallion was shot outside a Hollywood Hills home this past weekend. Now, although the details are very fuzzy, we know that the incident led to another Toronto rapper, his name is Tory Lanez, being arrested on felony weapon charges. Now, reports are suggesting that Tory shot Megan in the foot, but here is what Megan is saying in a new tweet. She says, "Black women are so unprotected. We hold so many things in to protect the feelings of others without considering our own. It might be funny to y'all on the internet and just another messy topic for you to talk about, but this is my real life and I'm real life hurt and traumatized." Whoa. I mean,
the video that came out, you could see she was bleeding from her foot.
She's
it
limping.
Looked traumatizing.
Yeah.
And I hope we find out what actually happened or she actually speaks up, because I'm sure there are a lot of other women that could use that support and hear her story.
Yeah. So who knows what's happening, but the story is developing and will come out very soon. Now let's get to Nick Cannon and some television news. Now y'all know he had a new talk show that was actually about to come out very soon, but it's being pushed back a year after his anti-Semitic comments. Now the production company Denbar Mercury, they said that Nick Cannon talk show will not debut this year after conversations with Nick. "We do believe that his public comments don't reflect his true feelings feelings, and his apology is heartfelt and sincere. We want to continue the healing process as he meets with leaders of the Jewish community and engages in a dialogue with our distribution partners to hear their views. The company said it's hoping that Nick Cannon will be able to air next year. So those are those pop culture stories that are trending right now.
All right, now coming up, this question has been around forever. Can money buy you happiness? Well, a new study says it can. More on that in 10 minutes. Now, a lot of us talk about this. We wonder, can money actually buy you happiness?
And when you say wonder, I feel like you really mean dream, because, honey, that, I feel like that finances and money and having enough is the dream, right?
I mean, that's what you think, you know, and there's new research that seems to be making us look at this question in a very different way than the past. Mm. And I want to bring in Helene Olin, who's an opinion columnist focusing on politics, economics, and American life at the Washington Post. Helene, thanks for being here as we talk about this.
Oh, thank you guys for having me on.
So it has been found that making above $75,000 doesn't really change your happiness. But what was discovered in this new study? Has that changed?
Well, first, I should say this: one of the things I discovered recently is the 75,000 number is a bit controversial. And there's one study that says people are not happier after they make more than 75,000. In fact, even in that study, it actually shows it's their daily happiness that doesn't improve, but their overall contentment is actually better. Mm. And another study came out about a year or two ago that found among millionaires, they all wanted more. Shocking, right? But that actually those who made more than 8 million or had a net worth of more than 8 million, I should say, were actually happier than those who had less than 8 million, which was also kind of surprising. It's kind of fascinating. But anyway, a new study came out that was really, really fascinating and kind of makes some sense out of all of this. Gene Twenge at UC San Diego went and looked at the surveys that are done by the General Social Survey, which is a project out of UChicago. Where they've been asking people questions about how happy you are for, I don't know, around 50 years or so, since the early 70s. One of the things she discovered was that when people were asked that question in the 1970s, there wasn't a huge difference or much difference at all between people who were working class, middle class, and upper class when they said, how happy are you? But as the income gap opened up, you began to see greater disparities. And in fact, that has become even more pronounced in recent years.
All right. Again, we are talking to Helene Olin, who's an opinion columnist at the Washington Post. And we're getting into the topic of happiness and can money actually buy you happiness? So with that said, I guess you're saying you need $8 million and money does buy you happiness. I mean, what are people supposed to do about this?
Well, I mean, this is where you have to start wondering what's going on. And when I start, you know, when you start looking at what's going on in our financial lives and you combine it with some of the studies on people and money, it actually starts to make sense. One of the things we know is that the cost of, even as salaries have stagnated for the most part in the United States, the cost of the things we really need, that's education, housing, healthcare, have gone up quite a bit. And that's relative to inflation. So even accounting for inflation, the example that gets used a lot is you're a two-income working couple and you buy childcare, you buy housekeeping, you buy somebody to do the laundry, right? Or somebody to do the laundry for you, you know, you buy that service. And that seems to make people somewhat happier. The other part of this is, as we also know, that people have taken on increasing amounts of debt to pay for a lot of this stuff.
And not to interrupt, but when I'm thinking about this, obviously it is heavy financial. Are they also adding in the layer of when it comes to like racial divides in America, especially in this country, and how that really impacts people?
Right. And the findings are actually interesting there too. And that was the happiness of African Americans, you know, was also fairly similar in the 1970s. Now, the happy, you know, in terms of what they relative to income. Now, there is a gap, but it's somewhat different than the gap among whites. And that is that the happiness among lower income to middle income African Americans has not fallen the way it has among whites. But what has happened is that the happiness of African Americans who would consider themselves upper middle class is actually the gap between the two groups has grown. Again, you're starting to guess at what's going on here. But one general thought is in a number of ways, and I say this as somebody who was actually alive in the 1970s, you know, there is less racism towards African Americans now than there was, you know, 40, 50 years ago. But it's still there, obviously.
I don't know if I necessarily agree with that, but I do think out on a level, if you're saying like back in the day it was at a 5, it most definitely has possibly decreased a little bit, but the thought of racism not being as prevalent as it was.
No, I didn't mean to say it wasn't as prevalent. What I meant to say is it's definitely decreased somewhat.
Well, I'm happy this is a more nuanced conversation because that question always, like, we would tend to simplify it, and it is something that's a bit more complicated. So we appreciate you for joining us for this today.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
Again, that was Helene Olin from The Washington Post. Now, coming up, we all have fond memories of college, don't we? Well, it turns out that COVID-19 could put an end to the college town. The implication is of that for students and these communities coming up in 10 minutes. We are back, and the pandemic forced college students around the country to evacuate campuses, as we know, in mid-March. Many moved home or off campus for the remainder of school. There is no clear return date in sight, it seems. We all know a lot of universities are announcing virtual classes, but a lot of people are wondering if COVID-19 could actually kill the college town. And with us right now is Dr. Stephen Gavazzi, who's a professor of human development and family science at Ohio State University. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks for allowing me on your show.
Okay, so our college town's over. Like, what happens now? What are the repercussions of what's happening?
To start out, it's important to note that many of these college towns have survived many other incidents in the past, including pandemics. The difference, I think, this time is that what we've seen over the years is an increased dependence on the university for virtually all of the economic well-being of these college towns. They used to be much more diversified.
Yeah. And I went to college for a little while in a small town where we had a small town, like downtown in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. And it was literally these local shops, restaurants, some bars. And I imagine now that these schools are trying to, you know, figure out how kids can return or students can return back on campus. And if not, they're going to this virtual. How big of an effect has it probably already had on them?
Yeah, it already has. Depending on where you do your polling data, anywhere between 10 and 30% of businesses have shut down, possibly permanently, as a result of the exodus last spring. The conservative estimate is that another half of these businesses will not survive if the universities do not remain open through fall semester.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty sad to see these towns who have become such mainstays becoming ghost towns. I guess, like, as someone who is a professor in human development at Ohio State University, we're talking to Dr. Stephen Gavazzi, how is this gonna impact these students as humans?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So colleges really have two jobs, and one is to create a degree that allows students to have access to a good paying job. But the other part of what they're supposed to do is to create a coming of age experience. Mm-hmm. And so that's very difficult to give in an online environment.
Very true. And I would love to know your perspective on the idea of, if let's just say things do kind of go back to normal, whatever that looks like, how do they switch the narrative or switch this system where it does seem like the economy of this town or any small town is relying on a university?
Well, I've watched universities take steps to do this already. For instance, Ohio University down in Athens, Ohio, has been touting the increased access to trail systems that they are basically promoting tourism. So that they aren't fully reliant on the university. I think that that's a big part of it. And then the other part of this is universities have increasingly been involved in economic development, which I'll just keep it short, means that they're creating new jobs with new technology.
Yeah, I mean, it's just crazy to think that this next generation won't experience things or see things that were so normal to all of us.
Yeah, it's, in some ways, my fear is that there's going to be a bit of a lost generation here, that there's going to be a year or 2 years that will disrupt the education of students who've already gone to school, will prevent some students from continuing their education, but also will dissuade certain students from even starting their education.
So are universities having that conversation about how they have to shift their way of thinking when it comes to not only the economy part of this, but also the human development of these students?
Well, they've been, I think, universities, to be fair, have been paying lots of attention to student-centered issues like this for a while. They just obviously, like no one else, could have anticipated a pandemic interrupting that. I think that there are universities across the nation who get lots of good celebratory claps for taking the time to keep those connections with students, even when they went into an online environment. But that only will go so far. And so I think that it's really going to be there's going to be a large demand on the creativity of university personnel to keep those kinds of connections if, in fact, we experience further disruptions in terms of in-person experience.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on your show.
That was, again, Dr. Stephen Gavazzi, professor for human development and family science at Ohio State University. Okay, now this little girl has some wise words about all of us getting along. It is literally the cutest thing I've seen all week. And we're playing it next in our Yaz Queen of the Day. Okay, we're wrapping up our show with our Yaz Queen of the Day now.
Oh, yes, queen.
And this is a perfect way to just end it all and put that package together.
You know, I really like the way I said yes, queen. It sounded like I was kind of responding to your statement by also giving like the yes, queen thing.
Okay, got it. I love it. All right, let's play this. This woman captured her daughter, who's very young. Like, I don't know, she's only a few years old. And she had the cutest advice for how to be better to each other. This is what only happens. I'm not a mom. Years. She's like only a few years old.
Okay.
So this is her advice on how we can all be better to each other and why it's so important. She's basically my spirit animal.
Mom, are you ready to be his friend?
Yes.
Try not to be that high up to be friends. I want everything to be low. Okay?
Okay.
Just try your best. I don't want you and my dad to be replaced in meanies again. I want you and my dad to be placed as settled and be friends. I'm not trying to be mean. I just want everyone to be friends. And if I can be nice, I think all of us can be nice too. I'm not trying to be mean, but I'm trying to do my best in my heart. Nothing else than that. I want you, Mom, my dad, everyone to be friends.
I mean, I don't know who taught her this, but she is like a Yoda, a mini Yoda.
I mean, yeah, it really does feel like you birthed her, but you didn't. But she is most definitely the cutest and dropping some wisdom. And I think it was really some like, it's a really good way to end the show on some good vibes, right? And I think she's right. If everyone's just nice, and if I can be nice, then how come y'all can't be nice? So I really appreciate those words. And it was really sweet.
My heart. I just want my heart to be happy and your heart to be happy. And we all gotta like do little, you know, don't go too low, don't go too high, just right here, right here.
Yeah, I mean, but wait till she becomes a teenager and she starts to understand how life really is. She'll hate everything.
No! Oh my God! Horrible!
So
horrible.
Yes, queen to that.
All right, well, that does it again for the show. But we'll be back next week, Monday through Friday, right here on Channel Q. On Monday, we're getting into, could anti-vaxxers be fueling mistrust of a COVID vaccine for people of color? We're also going to be talking about pandemic layoffs and how to turn that side hustle into a career. Why not? YOLO. That is on Monday's show. Let's go there with Cheer and Ryan, 4 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern. And if you missed any of our shows this week or interviews, we post everything and anything as a podcast, literally. Ryan is just uploading things like a free-for-all.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Just go to the radio.com app, search Let's Go There, and subscribe so you're notified when we post new episodes. We are sending you love and light.
And honey, remember to slay.
See you Monday. Have a great weekend.
Bye, y'all.